It's 2017. A hurricane passed damn near a month ago, and the power is still out.
Welcome to In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, hosting solo this week, while my co-host Maria Hinojosa is on a reporting trip. So 4 weeks after Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico, we're going to do a deep dive into the ongoing crisis. And this week, we're going to do things a bit differently. We're going to hear from two journalists who recently just came back from reporting trips on the island. And then we want to get their thoughts about what this means for the future of Puerto Rico. First up, Francis Robles, reporter for The New York Times. Hey, Frenchie.
Hi, how are you?
So, Frenchie, we're 4 weeks out from the first day that Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, and it's still a mess. So give me a bird's eye view of the situation on the island right now.
One thing that was really interesting about this hurricane, I've covered a lot of natural disasters, and usually you see like one place that got walloped, right? Where every house is a pile of toothpicks.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see that here. You saw a lot of the cement houses were fine. So if you're driving around Puerto Rico in general, you might look around and be like, oh, this isn't so bad. But what you don't realize, okay, every single street has X number of power lines down, poles all over the ground, all over Puerto Rico. Like, honestly, it's staggering to see. Like, you look around and
oh, like, you mean like the electrical poles are
everywhere? Yeah, the electrical poles are all on the floor. They're on the floor. Like, it's, you think about it and you're like, oh my God, they have to bring these up one by one? You know, this is going to take forever. The other thing that was really interesting, kind of a lesson that I learned, is that you could be looking around and everything looks fine and you don't realize that someone's roof, maybe there was just a tiny portion of the roof came off. But even with the tiny piece of the roof coming off, everything inside was soaked and everything was ruined.
What about nighttime? No one actually talks about nighttime in Puerto Rico.
So, you know, you'll be driving around. First of all, you try not to be doing this, right? So you generally want not to be driving around because the traffic lights are not working. So imagine every single traffic light everywhere is a four-way stop. So, you know, hope for the best, basically, at every single intersection. Hope that you don't, you know, hit somebody or get hit, or that there's still a tree or a pole or something that you didn't notice that you're about to run over. Most people don't have generators. I mean, I think that there's certainly more generators than you would see in, let's say, Miami or the Keys. You know, so there's some people have generators in their houses. But in general, if you're driving around at night, it's pitch dark. Unless you're in San Juan. San Juan, there's a little bit more, you'll see a little bit more lights going on. And so you're thinking, wow, it's 2017. A hurricane passed damn near a month ago. And the power is still out.
Yeah.
There's no air conditioning. There's no refrigerator. You know, my uncle is 80 years old. His insulin has been out of the refrigerator since the 20th of September.
My daughter's a type 1 diabetic. And like, I it's when you think about insulin, that stuff freaks the hell out of me.
I didn't know what to say to my uncle. I asked him, how are you doing? He's like, well, the insulin's out of the refrigerator, but I'm fine, I guess. You know, like, and I looked it up.
Geez.
It's okay for about a month, but it's very hot.
So what's the most recent story you were working on in Puerto Rico?
The last story that I did was really troubling. I spent several days visiting people who either were in the hospital or were sick or had loved ones who had died. And it was really, really worrisome, Julio. I found that, you know, where the government says on its website, the X number of dialysis centers, the vast majority of dialysis centers are open. Well, they don't tell you that people are getting their care rationed. So they're only getting 3 of the 4 hours of dialysis treatment they're supposed to get. Or oxygen. Well, I didn't realize that when you see those people lugging around oxygen tanks, those things require power at home. They don't have power at home. So people are dying of that.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing people die of a really horrible bacterial infection that comes from having been exposed in the water. It comes from rat urine that's in the water. And that's starting to spread. So it was just kind of a all around miserable situation. And I don't think it's getting that much better.
The death count is definitely underreported and it's definitely low. I think it's at 48, 49 now. Is it safe to say that everyone out there, like everyone seems to know that more people are going to die or have died from this? What's your gut telling you?
I think there's no question that more people have died or are going to die. One man that I interviewed, his daughter, he died because he had lacked oxygen for a week at home. And then I think he probably waited too long to go to the hospital. He died in the hospital. You know, maybe he died of natural causes, technically, on paper. He's not listed on the official death toll.
Right.
I don't hear people blaming the government per se. I don't think this is like a mass government conspiracy.
You mean the federal and the Puerto Rican government?
I mean the Puerto Rican government specifically. I think people have a sense that it's the hospitals that are lying to the government.
Really?
Because they don't, or they're going to say, oh, yeah, the power went out and then, boy, we couldn't get it together and everybody died, you know. So they have no interest in making it look like they were negligent in any way.
What's the biggest holdup in all this relief and recovery and sort of in trying to fix the situation?
I thought that to me, one of the biggest problems was the decision to have the food and the commodities distributed on the local level. So maybe this is something they do everywhere. I don't know. I was in Key West for Hurricane Irma, and I saw United States Marines standing in the parking lot of a supermarket handing out bags of ice and water. And so that level of, you know, soldier handing ice to the person is something that you didn't see in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So what they were doing is they distribute the aid to what's called the RSA, a regional staging area. And then it was up to the mayors to come pick it up. The mayors were not at all equipped to handle this job, you know, so they didn't have the gas or they didn't have the trucks. Sometimes they would have to leave food behind at the regional staging area because their trucks weren't big enough. They were showing up in pickups.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, every time you spoke to them and the government would be like, oh, no, we think this is great. This is great. You know, this is going really well. The next day they would say, oh, we're providing trucks for the mayors who don't have it. Ah, OK. So you know that the mayors don't have the trucks to come pick this stuff up. So in my humble opinion, and I have absolutely no training or expertise in disaster response, dumping it on the local level to distribute the aid was not that effective.
So with all these problems going on with distribution and aid, what's one major question you still want answered?
I want to know why the power is going to take so long to restore.
Mm.
There's kind of just a given that it's going to take 6 months to a year. Well, you know, how come? You know, like if that happened in Florida, could you imagine? I mean, we didn't have power here in the Keys for about 2 weeks. And, you know, we're ready to set our hair on fire. So let's try to fathom this debacle that is happening right now in Puerto Rico, happening anywhere else and it being tolerated. You almost get the impression that people in positions of power believe that Puerto Ricans were drinking out of streams anyway. It's like, no, actually they didn't. They were not bathing in the streams. They had running water in their homes.
Now we're starting to see like real stories. People are like, my boy, I'm done. Like, I'm going to Orlando or wherever. What was that sense when you were down there where people were like, I'm sticking through this no matter?
No.
Or like,
dame el jet blue.
Cuando el jet blue está aquí, ya me voy.
I'm done. I'm out. Peace out. Like, it was funny. One lady said, ¿Qué va a estar aquí para levantar? You know, like, who's going to be left to pick up the pieces? The supermarkets are not accepting. I don't know if they've resolved the food stamp issue, but for several weeks, the food stamp issue was really problematic because most of the stores didn't have the system to process the cards. People didn't have enough cash. So if you're living with no cash, where your food stamps aren't being accepted, where you have no fan, no electricity, no air conditioning, maybe even no running water, there's a disease coming in through the public source of water that you've been using, and you have a sister who lives in Orlando, where are you going to go?
So people are like, maybe I'm out of here.
The unemployment line at the Department of Labor in Puerto Rico is running around the block. Burger King, the McDonald's, all of those places are closed. People work at those places. You know, those are the jobs.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. I can't even do the math of how many people are out of work.
What about the attitude on the island? How are people feeling?
I don't want to suggest that because people are committed to improving their stock and leaving that they don't have resiliency. I mean, the resilience that I saw was really astounding and it was impressive. people were all, when they talk about, oh, the Army Corps of Engineers is doing debris removal or road clearing. Well, get road clearing. The people cleared those roads. The people came out of their houses and they cleared the roads. They chopped down the trees. They tied up the power lines and have them there ready for the electric company to come pick them up. But I think if you have a solution, you're going to leave. If you can, you will. You would interview people like, oh, isn't it terrible living without electricity?
Hey, this is Noam, producer here at In the Thick. We love reading reviews from listeners here at the show, and we also love to share them with you. So here's one great review from listener Yes Please. Thank you for sharing your insight and perspective and for allowing us to further educate ourselves on topics, perspectives, and issues related to POC communities. This is the podcast I've been looking for. Thanks. And if you're a fan of In the Thick, try our sister podcast, Latino USA. The story of rock and roll is normally told in terms of black and white. Country met the blues, had a baby, and it was rock music. But Latinos have been a part of rock since the beginning, from the arrival of the guitar to the very first punk rock band. That's this week on Latino USA. And next week, Latino USA will have a full hour on the ongoing crisis in Puerto Rico. Subscribe to Latino USA wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, hosting solo this week, while my co-host Maria Hinojosa is away on a reporting trip. Today, we're hearing from two reporters who recently got back from Puerto Rico. We just heard from Francis Robles, reporter for the New York Times. Next up, Andres Caballero, producer for Latino USA. So Andres, you just got back from Puerto Rico.
Yes.
What story were you working on?
So 2 days after a day after the hurricane hit, we're talking September 21st, I went online and I ran into an article by the Marshall Project that in its headline talked about the 29 prisons in Puerto Rico and how they were built along coastal areas or areas near high flood risk zones. This caught my attention. Obviously, during a natural disaster of this proportion, we tend to, you know, not prioritize those in prison. That's just the way that we've been behaving as a society.
Yeah, I mean, that goes without saying.
Many examples.
Yeah.
And so, I just wondered what was going on in the prisons. And then I found on the corrections Facebook, all these family members that were leaving really angry messages and asking questions. Can we get more information about this one prison? You know, are our loved ones okay? Nobody was getting any answers. So I reached out to some of these family members just to kind of get a sense of, you know, what's going on. Like, tell me what it is that you're worried about. What's the scenario as far as getting in touch? What have you heard? And so that's kind of how I just decided to go to Puerto Rico to find out and maybe deliver the messages that these family members had for their loved ones.
So how did you go about getting in touch with all these prisons?
So I started flooding the Department of Corrections with phone calls for dates and leaving voicemails until I realized that that was useless too at the time.
They were like, that's not working.
No. So I happened to be at the convention center where it was the center of, you know, where the media was operating, Central Command and so on, FEMA. And my friend, who's a journalist, a Puerto Rican journalist with Radio Isla, told me, just follow me. The corrections press guy is here in this building.
Oh.
He took me to the corrections guy who was having lunch. I apologized. I told him what I was looking for. Obviously, we were in an unprecedented time, and I wouldn't do this, but I really need your help. I put in the official request, and then from there was a matter of waiting. I was supposed to wait for this lady to follow through with me. That didn't happen for days, so okay. I just decided to get in my car and drive to Bayamon Correctional Complex. As soon as I got to the checkpoint, I said, look, I'm a producer coming from New York. I need help. I've been trying to get through to the corrections, press people, nothing. I just need to deliver this message from a mother to an inmate. She hasn't heard from him since the hurricane passed. She's worried to death. Many families are. Can you help me get this message delivered to an inmate at your maximum security prison right here at the 292 Bayamon? So what I ended up doing, I ended up getting access to the prison, one guy in Bayamon, the maximum security prison, and two guys in Guayama.
So you finally get to the prison. What was it like?
So when I went in the prison, there was nothing really that stood out. I knew that they had lost electricity. They were still running the prison with a generator. Mm-hmm. In the middle of my interview, the whole power went out in the prison. Obviously, you think about what the effects of not having electricity. We're seeing what it's doing to Puerto Rico right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you wonder how it is inside the prisons. The next day, I was able to visit the other prison in the south. Cables everywhere. The main expressway was reopened, but, you know, you see trees all over, mm-hmm. fallen, and the ones that are standing or have been stripped off their leaves completely. Puerto Rico has lost its, you know, lush.
Se fue el verde. All the green is gone. Was that what you saw?
That's what I saw. Wow. It's gone. It's a very, very sad scene. So I go to Guayama, and I see these parents parked outside one of the medium security prisons. They were waiting to do their visits. And so I went up and I asked them, like, you know, have you seen your loved ones since the hurricane? What did they say? Mm-hmm. What's it like in there? And immediately one of the father of someone in there said that the prison actually flooded, that the water rose, and that they had to transfer all the prisoners from the first floor to the second level. The cells became overcrowded because of that, that there were three or four to a cell during the hurricane, that they were only drinking water and eating bread for the first 2 days. And the ventilation was an issue as well. Humid, very muggy. I can't imagine being in a prison without electricity.
Wow. And you reported another intense story while you were there, right?
Yes. There's a town called Ay Bonito. I visited that town another time. I actually drove there to look for a place that took care of elders. And I visited this house called Hogar Dulce Vida, run by a lady named Nancy Mejias, who in the middle of the storm found out there was a kid, a young man, 23-year-old Marquitos, who had a condition. It was a deformative condition that didn't allow him to develop his limbs. He was in the parking lot of a hospital, plugged into a generator, which powered his ventilator, which allowed him to breathe. So basically, without this generator, Marquitos would have died, and he had nowhere else to go but the parking lot of this hospital. And so this lady, Nancy, who ran the home for the elders, took him in to her place where they had a generator. And she wasn't certified to have anyone who wasn't an elder, but she still took a risk. And that's where Marquitos was, at the mercy of this generator that ran the ventilator, and also at the mercy of having enough diesel.
It's a diesel economy right now, is what they say. And like that story of Marquitos, it's just one of many. Like, you know, I've heard too many stories about hospitals and when the power goes out. The scary thing about this, Andres, is like, you're like the 10th journalist who's told me a similar story. A person literally just completely dependent on a generator to keep them alive. And for a longer version of Andres's story, check out next week's episode of Latino USA. Finally today, we're going to take a quick temperature check with both Frenchie and Andres. This is really more about the emotions going on right now. So, Frenchie, how are you personally feeling 4 weeks out from Hurricane Maria?
It broke my heart. It really did. You know, I know, what's that Tom Hanks movie? You know, there's no crying in baseball.
Yeah, League of Their Own.
League of Their Own. Well, there's no crying in journalism, right? So, on this story, I actually twice found myself in the middle of an interview with like a tear rolling down my face. And I was like, wow, how did that happen? You know, that never happens to me ever, 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 ever.
That's a big thing for you to say that.
I mean, never in the middle of the line, he could see me. She was sitting right there. And I'm like, oh, so she was telling me about how her father, it was the lady whose father had died after running out of oxygen. It wasn't even the dying part that got me. It was that her father's body was not refrigerated for almost a week. And so the funeral director came to her and said, I cannot embalm him because it's a black, you know, decomposed corpse. It's already rotted. And that was the moment that I felt so sad. I thought, what is the future of this place where people can't even have a dignified burial? What is going to happen here? How many people like that man, Harry Figueroa, are going to be the unintended consequence of this nightmare?
Andres, how are you feeling about all this?
I feel really sad. When leaving, I felt really powerless. I can come into a place, yeah, and tell some stories, but what am I really doing for people? And you would like to think that your work has some sort of impact. I personally felt really pessimistic about the future, the little that I know, the little that I learned while there, when I hear things about, you know, the whole power grid of Puerto Rico being destroyed and the domino effect that that brings for the future of the island, not just the fact of like having something to power your things with, but it's the entire economic future. Like, what's next for Puerto Rico? Will people be able to rebuild their lives? Will their standard of living be the same in years to come after this? They are just not getting the help that they should be getting as a territory of the United States.
That feeling of being distant is very real for me because I have yet to go home. So it's been really hard for me to watch the last 4 weeks and experience it through the words of others. I don't know how I'm going to react when I get back home. And I'm almost kind of pushing it aside. You know, 4 weeks into this and people still don't have any power or water. And the new normal is I don't know what the hell that is. And so I've been thinking a lot about the future of Puerto Rico and wondering if this is the transformative moment for the island. Uno, dos, tres. Francis Robles, reporter for The New York Times, and Andres Caballero, producer for Latino USA, thanks so much for joining me on In the Thick.
Absolutely. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for having me, Julio.
I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. And remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. It really, really helps. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell all your friends about our show. Our producer is Noam Hassenfeld. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. Some of our music is composed by Noam, and the other music you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZK Records. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening. Nos vemos.